Hey everybody, welcome back to Explain Like I'm 5, the podcast where we take the questions you always wanted to ask and talk about them in a way that's easy to understand. We are your hosts, I'm Tim.
And I'm Kevin.
So Kevin, today we're talking about trains. Trains are fascinating vehicles, but we're going to focus on train tracks today. How is it that trains maintain traction on these steel tracks, especially in rainy or icy conditions?
First of all, the wheels of a train are made of a specialized steel alloy that provides pretty excellent grip on the steel rails. The wheels are also slightly conical in shape, which also helps them bite, you know, into the rails. Additionally, trains use a system called wheel slip control to prevent the wheels from spinning too fast and losing traction. And this is a really important system because it senses when the wheels are starting to slip and automatically reduces the power to those wheels until traction is regained. In icy or wet conditions, trains may also use a technique called sanding, where sand is automatically dropped onto the rails in front of the wheels. And what this does is it increases the friction and prevents the wheels from sliding. You know, modern trains can even detect when the rails are slippery and automatically activate the sanding system.
How do the wheels stay on the tracks themselves without slipping off? Because they are still smooth and somewhat round.
The key to that question is the shape of the rail itself. So train rails have a distinctive inverted T shape with a wide flat base that is very secure to the ground, and then a narrower top section that the wheels ride on. And I mentioned up front that the wheels of a train are slightly conical. What this means is that they are wider at the outer edge than the inner edge. So as the train moves, the wheels naturally just want to center themselves on the rail, with the wider outer edges gripping the sides of the rail. This self-centering effect basically keeps the wheels from ever, you know, really sliding off the tracks, even on curves.
Very interesting. So one thing you always notice about train tracks is that there are stones and gravel surrounding the tracks. What's the purpose of that? They seem very important.
Good observation. Those stones and gravel you see are very important, so much so that they have a special name. They are called ballast, and they serve a few important functions. First of all, they provide a stable and well-drained foundation for the railroad ties and rails. This helps prevent the tracks from shifting or settling over time, which could definitely lead to derailments. Second, the ballast also helps with water drainage, allowing all that rain and melting snow to flow away from the tracks rather than pooling underneath. And so this helps prevent the formation of mud and ice that could also compromise traction. Third of all, the ballast acts as a shock absorber, cushioning the impact of the heavy train cars and distributing the weight just, you know, more evenly. This overall helps protect the underlying soil and reduces maintenance needs as well. And finally, the ballast makes it easier to perform track maintenance, as the loose stones can be easily removed and replaced as needed.
That all makes a lot of sense. Now, what are the factors that determine the maximum speed a train can go given a track?
There are several factors that go into determining the max safe speed for a train on a particular section of a track. And I think the most important ones are things like the track curvature, the grade and or slope of the track, and the overall condition of the rails and the infrastructure. So, you know, when you have sharper curves and steeper grades, it definitely requires trains to travel at lower speeds to maintain that stability and prevent derailment. There's even some systems they can implement, like the positive train control, which can, well, automatically slow down or stop a train if it's, you know, exceeding safe speeds. In general, it's just all about finding that sweet spot between efficiency and risk mitigation.
We'll come to that positive train control in just a second, but how did trains in the 1800s make sure they were not on a collision course with another train traveling in a different direction?
Oh, well, back then, it was all about scheduling. You're totally right that train collisions were a major issue in the early days of trains. I mean, back in the 1800s, trains didn't even have a sophisticated signaling or communication systems that we have today. So the primary method of collision avoidance was something they used called a timetable and train order operation. Essentially, each train was assigned a specific schedule, and conductors had to strictly adhere to their timetable to avoid any conflicts. Dispatchers would also issue written train orders to conductors, informing them of any changes or exceptions to, you know, the normal schedule they're expecting. However, this system was obviously far from foolproof, right? Like, you got things like weather delays, mechanical failures, and also just simple human error that could lead to trains still ending up on the same track at the same time. And unfortunately, collisions were all too common in those early days. It wasn't until, I think, the late 1800s that more advanced signaling systems started to emerge, using everything from telegraph technology to communicate between stations and provide visual signals to train crews.
I see. And today, then, what are the safety measures in place to prevent train collisions? They must be much more advanced.
So the backbone of modern train collision avoidance is something called the Positive Train Control, or PTC. And the PTC uses things like GPS and wireless communications, and also track-side sensors to continuously monitor the location of trains and automatically intervene if a collision is imminent. The PTC can automatically slow down or even stop a train if it's approaching another train or exceeding speed limits or just entering an area where maintenance is being performed. It essentially provides an extra layer of protection beyond the eyes and ears of the train crew.
So with all these safety systems in place, why isn't train automation more a focus compared to, say, self-driving cars? Why is that?
That's a really excellent question, especially in these times. I would say there's a few key reasons. So first of all, trains operate on a fixed infrastructure of tracks, right? And that is all highly regulated and actually quite difficult to modify. Adapting that infrastructure to support full automation would be quite a massive engineering challenge. Trains also carry much heavier payloads than cars, so the consequences of a system failure or malfunction are much more severe. The rail industry tends to be much more risk-averse and prefers to rely on human operators as a safeguard, at least for now. And additionally, the rail industry is also a lot more fragmented, with many different operators, manufacturers, and regulators involved. So coordinating the development of a standardized autonomous system across this diverse landscape is harder than the more centralized automotive industry. Now, that said, the technology is advancing rapidly, and you are starting to see some more automated features being introduced.
So finally, people talk about railroad tracks having a gauge. What does that mean?
Oh, so yeah, that's another interesting historical tidbit. The track gauge is defined as the distance between the two rails of a railway track. And lo and behold, there are varying track gauges used around the world. There's even a name for the standard gauge, which is of, 4 feet, 8.5 inches, which became the most common around the world because the original two lines that used it, the Stockton and Darlington line, and then the Liverpool and Manchester Railway, was basically the first intercity line, were both incredibly successful and both use the same gauge. So standard gauge is used in most of Europe and America. But some other gauges, like a narrower 3 feet or a broader 5 feet gauge, were also adopted, often based on regional preferences or limitations. And so the diversity of these gauges created some pretty unique challenges for interconnectivity, which also led to the development of track gauge convergent technologies. And some countries even have dual gauge tracks to accommodate all these different train types so they can all move around.
Interesting. Thanks, Heaven. Did you learn something new? If you did, send us an email. We are at eli5thepodcast@gmail.com. We love hearing from you, especially when you've got comments and suggestions for us. If you are a regular listener of this podcast, please take the time to leave us a review on Spotify or iTunes. It only takes 2 minutes, and it really helps other people to find our podcast, so we really appreciate that. As always, thanks to the community at r/explainlikeim5, and we will see you all next week. We'd like to make sure our listeners know about The Kevin Rose Show, a podcast that we are both huge fans of.
The Kevin Rose Show offers a unique blend of some pretty non-conventional wisdom, some tactical life and health hacks, some finance tips, and even a bunch of entrepreneurial advice.
Some of you may know Kevin Rose as the entrepreneur who founded Digg, but what I love about Kevin is that he is always predicting the future.
Man, he was already talking about Bitcoin way back in 2011, 2012.
Kevin has had some great guests on his show, like Andrew Huberman, Chris Dixon, Elon Musk, Tony Robbins, Chris Voss, and Tim Ferriss.
He even had the Wealthfront founder, Andy Ratcliffe, on the show. And I know a lot of Eli 5 listeners are really interested in investing and economics.
And then there's a recent episode with Casey Means on metabolism that is a must listen.
So go check it out, and you'll see why we're both such huge fans. Search The Kevin Rose Show on your favorite podcast app.